Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I'm here to talk about how we should organize operations in, I guess, the 21st century, web service architecture, stuff like that. So let me start by talking a little bit about Heroku. Some of you may have heard of us, some of you may not have. We're a platform as a service. It kind of means that we're ops as a service, right? You give us your code, and you tell us how many web processes you want and how many database followers you want. We make sure that all those resources continue to exist and are available for you and running your code. We have about 133,000 requests per second on average, and we don't have a low part of our traffic graph, so we're worrying about this stuff all the time. Why am I giving this talk? People ask me what I do. It can be hard to decide how to answer. Depending on the perspective of the person who's asking me, which I often don't know, it's hard to decide what level of detail to go into. People are interested in how Heroku handles our operations. We like talking about that. That's another good reason. I think what we do is cool, and I like talking about it. Many people like the sound of their own voice. That would include me. One of the Lisa organizers asked me about it when we were discussing my other submissions. Like, how does Heroku handle this? How do you partner with your customers to manage operations? So there's clearly something to talk about here. But this talk is only about how Heroku does this thing and why it makes sense for us. Your context might be very different. So I want to say up front that this is not applicable to everybody and it may not apply to you. I am going to say a few words about myself, which I don't always, but I think that in this case, my perspective is really critical to how I assembled this talk, so it will help you to know where I'm coming from. I started off in a NOC. I spent years going back and forth between tech support, system administration, a smidge of network administration, and a brief detour through affordable housing compliance. I am not a developer, and I never have been. I have carried a pager. I have paged other people. Sometimes one of those things has been true at one time, and sometimes both of those things have been true at one time. I've worked in places where I was told very explicitly that I should not bother the developers because their time was more valuable than mine. That's a lot of words, little contraction-y things. What even are all of these things? People ask me, what is DevOps? You do it, right? What is it? Can you tell me what it is? I don't understand. People are using this word, and I don't know where it's coming from. One answer is when developers are responsible for their code even after it's been deployed. Another answer, agile for operations. The answer that I've come up with after a lot of thinking about it is that DevOps is the care and feeding of computer systems in a dynamic context. That's different from writing an app that runs on a computer that a person interacts with. It's different from sort of the traditional Microsoft Office that you install from physical media. For me, DevOps is related to things like service-oriented architecture and infrastructure as code, and is maybe not really separable from those concepts. The combination of regularly changing code in a regularly changing context creates new challenges, and using a traditional dev creates, ops maintains model doesn't handle these challenges very well. So that's DevOps, maybe. What then does SRE mean? I also get asked this a lot. The answer that I usually give is a pretty high-level answer. If you're going to sell a web service for a living, it's a good idea to have a team whose job it is to make sure that that service continues to stay up even as you change it and make it more complex. That's how we think about the role of my team at Heroku. For us, that means using a lot of things, including consulting on monitoring and alerting. We determine how Heroku measures and displays our uptime. We determine how we run incidents. That's mostly specifically my job. We work with teams on how to understand the architecture that they're responsible for. It's stuff that's common to understanding and preserving uptime for most or all of the engineering teams in Heroku. This is pretty different from how Google handles it, which, you know, Google is the company that we've all been talking about this year as they put out this book about service reliability engineering, because we use something called a total ownership model, and that was my reaction when I first heard that phrase. This is one of the things, like the word DevOps, like, you know, it's kind of hard to pinned down, but it's sort of similar concept. When developers are responsible for the operation of their code in a production environment, that's right, when everything from beginning to end, the maintenance, the upkeep, the ongoing features, f- feature creation, that's basically a total ownership model. My first experience with it was when I joined AWS and I was working for their premium support org, and it was a revelation at that time for me. So why do we think this is a good model? Short feedback cycles are the best way to get stuff done quickly, the best way to learn things quickly. This is what we talk about with agile development, right? You want to make a change, you want to see if it works, then you want to make another small change. You don't want to pile up all your stuff and release it all at once and then find out that nobody actually wanted the thing that you were writing. Kathy Sierra gave a talk at O'Reilly Fluent about this. The fastest way to learn a simple task is not to be told how to do it. It's to try it and to get feedback on whether you did it right, and then to try it again and do it again and do it again. The example that she gave, which is apparently a really classic example in this kind of learning study, is chick sexing, which is to say that when you have a chick, it is almost impossible to tell whether it's going to be a hen or a rooster just by looking at it, except that some people can. Most of the people who can tell can't really train other people how to do it very well. It's, well, I'm seeing some things, but I may be seeing some other things, and maybe I don't even know which things that I'm seeing that are telling me what I think this chick is going to grow up to be. And it turns out that the fastest way to train new people to become expert in this task is to have the new person pick up a chick, look at it, and make a guess. And the expert will say yes or no. And they do this over and over and over and over again. It actually only takes a few hours before the new person is an expert at this task. It's a small task, quick feedback, doing it over and over again. So if you have one team write the service and another team take the pages, you break that feedback loop. The team doing the writing no longer understands the results of the actions that they've taken. Since tight feedback loops are the best way to run a system, and this is something that factory flow control folks have known for many years, it's something that we can apply to web services too. Some people have a really emotional reaction to this. And I can appreciate that. It's very different from the way a lot of people have done business for, at this point, a lot of time. It's like, it's everybody has to reorganize how they think about what their job is if you make this change. Developers have a rep for not knowing enough about practical concerns. This can make people on both sides of the traditional ops dev divide really nervous when they think about having developers hold a pager and try to fix things that are wrong in production in real time. But we mostly no longer write things in C. Developers are not creating artisanal hand-foraged memory maps anymore. Languages take care of that for us now much more often than they did before. That frees up mental resources for us to create more complex things. But also, how is a person supposed to write a complex web service that interacts with other complex web services when they don't know how to run or manage a complex web service? This building might be familiar to some of you. This is the MIT Stata Center. This is what happens when a person makes a thing and there's no feedback loop for them about how that worked out for the people who are dealing with it. Right? Some of you know some of these stories. I can hear it. This building was made with discontinuous cable trays, server rooms that did not sufficiently keep the rain out. It has a lecture hall that makes presenters dizzy. And many winters, there is an ice problem that closes off the most visible entrance to the building, and they have to put up cones and signs and tell people to go around. Frank Gehry is the architect for this building, and he has gone on the record saying that he can't be held responsible for the failures of this building because buildings always have problems. I've heard that a lot of places before, but none of them were good. So, basic flow control diagram of your standard ops dev divide. It looks nice, right? It looks tidy. It looks like you've got a good feedback loop there. Feedback goes from ops to dev. That influences production. But let me put labels on some of those arrows. I don't know about you, but I pay more attention to pages than I do to emails. But it's worse than that. Let me add some stuff that helps demonstrate the importance of all of these things to the company. Now it really looks not good, doesn't it? American culture valorizes people who make new things and who solve problems, and it denigrates people who do maintenance work. Handymen, janitors, paving crews. Our industry doubles down on this. It's worse, like the way that we think about that is even more intense than the regular culture. So aside from the carrier problem of emails versus pages, a lack of respect for an ops team is enshrined into the organization of a company. They can't get anyone who gets more respect than they do do anything that they need, and they can't get the company to invest in their career development or quality of life, so they're stuck. And this is the case anywhere they go. They can switch to another company and be on another ops team, and it still looks like that. This is the exact equivalent of something that we've all dealt with, and that I at least have lived, when a company's support folks are isolated from the developers because their time is more important and valuable than mine, and they don't have the authority to even get in contact with anyone who has the authority to fix things for customers. And we've all had that experience of calling a support team and having them basically blow us off because they don't have any way to help. Sociologists who study work, class, and gender talk about how the status that our culture ascribes to a certain kind of job changes with the kind of people who we picture to be the default person doing that job. That's why this field is now fairly high status. When the people were the computers and they were mostly women, it was low status. There's a book called The Computer Boys Takeover that talks about this sort of cultural progression in the field. But now that we call them programmers and mostly white men do it, it's very high status. A combination of high status people doing work with a variety of high and low statuses can keep the people doing that work from being sectioned off into a part of the org without enough clout to get things done. So if you have your developers on call, it subverts some of this class-based notion of work that we all carry around with us. Alice Goldfuss wrote a great post, which went up yesterday, about on-call culture and how traditional ops teams have very little to be proud of except their ability to take punishment and be heroes. This is, one, totally correct, and two, what the organization puts them in the position of doing. This is a problem that is inherent to the existence of operations teams. This quote was one line of a very long post, mostly about the pathological pressures on ops teams, but it was the one that the internet reacted really, really strongly to. Because people who haven't traditionally been on call don't want to start being on call. I mean, that's kind of obvious, right? It's not the most fun thing in the world. But also, many of them think it's beneath them. And if you read the replies that she got, that will become clear very quickly. A lot of people are offended at the idea that they should have to take on this low-status work when they haven't had to in the past. But wouldn't you like to know that your work is valuable? Wouldn't you like to know that your service functions well? Wouldn't you like the feedback and the certainty that you're doing something in the world that matters to people? This is like why Marxism is a thing. If you section off people from any knowledge of the relevance or the impact or the usability of their work, if they can't tell that their efforts provide value for anyone, their work lives are much less rewarding and much less stimulating. So if you stop having an ops team to cover for the issues that other people create, your flow control diagram looks more like this. This is a much more effective system, right? The feedback is much more direct. Devs are getting the feedback themselves, and they're also understanding the severity of that feedback in a very real-time and personal manner. That feedback is going straight to the people who can fix the problems that have been created. All of this reduces the incentives that create rock stars and heroes. It becomes more useful to collaborate with each other and less useful to take pride in the number of hours you can work or the amount of pain that you can absorb. Some of you have probably seen this before, possibly even in the overview to this talk. Making this change to your organization also takes advantage of Conway's Law. Melvin Conway is a computer programmer. He's still around. If you're here, hello and thank you. He coined this in 1968. This is not new news, right? We've known this for a little while. If you create a team which is where feedback goes to die, it will show in your product. You will have a much harder time improving your product. You will be discarding the data that you need in order to make those changes. And if you're in the business of web services or mobile apps, making small, quick, routine improvements is the name of the game. Discarding the information that you need in order to make those changes is not a sound business strategy. So, one example, working in support. I worked on AWS Premium Support for 2 years. In some ways, it was one of the best experiences I've ever had working support. If the devs pushed a bad release, either their monitoring would page them and I wouldn't have to, or in the case where customers or I did discover it first, I got to page them directly, instead of having to page a team who would have to try to diagnose the problem with almost as little information as I had. Having developers on call kept them closer to the experience of customers, and it reduced the time that it took to get someone engaged who could fix things. It made whatever was going on with customers closer for the devs. It made it much more personal to them. They were able to perceive it in their day-to-day work lives, and it mattered. I mean, you would hear them talk about it, right? Like, bad customer experience, or, you know, if we push that, it's not going to work for this certain section of people. And if you have the insulation of both an ops team and a support team in the way, devs don't get to have that insight. Another example, the Heroku data offering, well, multiple offerings. Heroku Data has a system that manages database data stores that customers create. It performs various routine maintenance on the tasks, and when things go wrong, it attempts to resolve the issue itself before paging a human. The system is possible only because developers are on call for Heroku Data. Both they and the company are incentivized to use their expensive high-status time in the most effective way possible. When they can't, that is a problem that everyone notices. You know, progress on the roadmap slows down, sometimes to a halt. Things start to change. One more example, retrospectives. Teams at Heroku conduct incident retrospectives whenever there's a customer-facing issue. Everyone involved in responding to the incident comes together to talk in a blameless manner about what happened and what we'd like to change. The group comes up with remediation ideas, and these ideas go into the backlogs of the teams whose services were affected by the incident. Each team then handles each of these items with that team's standard planning process. When I first started doing this, it sounded like kind of a bad idea to me. I was like, well, you know, we kind of got to push them, right? It's never fun to do maintenance compared to implementing new features, right? But it turns out if you get paged often enough, maintenance starts to look like a lot more fun. And here's that type feedback loop again. This is why this works. So, to not have a Pollyanna story, what happens when it's all on fire? What are the downsides? Burnout can still happen. Inheriting code bases now means inheriting operational pain instead of just code that you don't know. And when things are on fire badly enough, it might still be impossible to fix them because too much is broken and you are just scrambling behind all of the pages and all of the operational pain that you're getting. But I think everyone is still in a better place when this happens. All of those failure modes happen to operations teams too. Most of us in this room have probably lived through that sort of thing, one if not all of those problems. But when it happens to an ops team, they're frequently unable to affect the change that they need. People wind up leaving. Usually no one with authority gets involved to change things until most of your ops team has left or turned over and the new folks are struggling even harder than the experienced people were. But because of the status of a developer team, the organization is more likely to rearrange resources to try to get them out of that place of fire before things get super bad. The problem that comes along with a total ownership model that you basically can't avoid is commonly referred to as silos. This is where two adjacent teams wind up implementing different solutions to the same or a similar problem. But it's not always a weakness. Sometimes problems look the same, but they aren't when you get really close. Sometimes if you design one thing to solve the same problem in two different contexts, you wind up with poor abstraction or data model choices that you might have made differently if you did it to two separate times. Interfaces between services can add resiliency. This is one of the reasons that we don't all still use monolithic Rails apps. If two teams each develop their own solution, one of them might have better performance characteristics over reliability and wind up being adopted in multiple places. Teams who write their own solutions are more familiar with them, and they have a better time maintaining them than a solution that they adopt from someone else. But nothing's to say they can't sit down and work on the problem together if they want. Even so, if both teams are aware of having the same kind of problem, they can still collaborate. And open source is still a thing, and a lot of people that I know would still rather use it than write their own. So where does that leave ops folks? It's important to be honest that this proposal is in some ways what I spent years being afraid of. That I would either have to scrape together enough high-quality brain time after hours and between pages to magically become a developer, or that I would be rendered obsolete and have to find a new industry. I was very afraid of this. It's facile and cheap to talk about retraining. That's making the individual responsible for covering for the failures of the system, and that's what my entire talk and Alice's entire post is about and why those things are problems. You can't do that. It doesn't fix it. But where it does leave ops people, it leaves us the experts. We're good at knowing what good operational practices are. Lots of current ops folks are ideally skilled to go into SRE orgs like the one that I'm in, the way that Heroku does this, where we consult with development teams on monitoring alerting, help orchestrate the response to complex operational incidents, investigate the interconnections between clusters of incidents, and we highlight burnout risks. Lots of us have great systems thinking skills and lots of experience with complex distributed systems. In this model, the former ops folks are respected subject matter experts who have important things to do, and an important thing for us not to do is to take pages for other people for stuff that we didn't write. So, what's my point? Feedback is the best way to learn. Feedback is the best way to improve something. Feedback is no good if you don't have the power to change things. Having an ops team disconnects the feedback from the people who can change things and creates an underclass of workers in a toxic environment. Toxic environments encourage hero or rockstar behavior, which is anti-collaborative and is bad for people, teams, and products. Knowing that your work is useful and effective is satisfying. But most importantly, do your bit isn't the right way to think about the services that we're creating now. We all need to be systems thinkers, and we need to change the industry. Let's change our organizations so we can work together more effectively and set everyone up for success. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. If you have questions, please step up to the microphone. If you have more of a comment than a question, please find me afterwards so that we can answer questions.
We've got about 10 minutes for questions, so don't be shy.
Hi, my name is Connie Lynn Lani, and I'm a Usenix co-chair for next year. I wanted to know, so this is all really excellent advice when you're kind of starting fresh. Do you have good advice on transforming an organization that may be following some of what you identified as broken patterns?
Yeah, so I thought about that. I spent a while thinking about that, and I've never lived through that happening. I feel like if I were to join an organization where that were happening, I would have things that I could say. Maybe we should get coffee or a beer and talk about it. I don't know if I can distill it down right now because I haven't lived it.
Yeah.
Hi, Paul Krizak, Qualcomm. In a world where, you know, as you kind of described, you know, ops kind of, you know, distills, you know, distributes its way out into dev, what happens to the lowest level of system administration? I'm talking specifically the, you know, deciding which boxes to buy and racking and stacking and cabling and making sure the, you know, network is active. What happens to that kind of ops?
Right. So the answers that I've seen are twofold. Heroku uses AWS. AWS uses dedicated teams. So they have dedicated procurement teams that manage the hardware for different services, and different services have different specs that they need, so those sort of teams work together to figure out what actually should be bought. They have dedicated racking and stacking teams in data centers. The way I always try to describe it so that my Heroku coworkers who haven't worked there can understand what it's like is that basically AWS has racks marching in the door 24/7 like ants, right? So they have a huge organization to deal with this. This is how when we make these changes, we're kind of moving the pain, which I think is something that many of us will have experienced in managing services, right? You know, we made this better, but now that hurts more because we can take more capacity over here and we just overwhelm this database. Those teams don't get a lot of respect, but they're bigger and they have, you know, their own VPs, so that does help.
Would you describe that as like almost like a rebranding effort, that instead of being the ops team, now they're the data center procurement team or something? It becomes something that maybe is easier to describe the value to the organization?
Right, yeah, procurement, purchasing, data center operations, that kind of thing is how they tend to name it, yeah.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
So while we wait for him to come up to the mic, I also have a question.
Yeah.
If somebody came up to you and said, I want to start making this change, I'm at the bottom level, I'm not management, what's the one thing I can do right now today, go back to my management or whatever, what's the one thing I could do to start this environment, from get it going?
To get it going. Well, the beginning of that sort of change is always a hearts and minds conversation. I would go look for someone to be an executive sponsor of this effort and try to convince them. Either point to Alice's post, point to this talk. Other people have written smart things on this topic. Talk about the ways in which this creates a better product and try to get someone who's higher up in the food chain than you to start moving this forward with you. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Hi, my name's Indy. I worked with you in a previous life at Vano.
Hello.
So I work at Amazon Search. One of the things that's very fashionable there is the two pizza team, and that
yes.
Every service with inside Amazon should be a microservice and should be feedable by two pizzas, and those teams do coding, test, ops, total ownership for that microservice. What is your experience in getting teams which don't have a dedicated ops hat to talk to each other in ops-relevant terms?
Well, within the context of AWS, there was something that one of the original Amazonians started, and it got derailed by some other, you know, executive push. She was going to try to compare operational postures across at least AWS. I don't remember if she was also working with retail. And talk about what people considered to be best practices, what people considered to be bad numbers in terms of pages, where we should start to be afraid. It was fascinating. We met twice. I was working on S3 at that time, and I told the group how many pages S3 primary got in a week, and there was dead silence for about 15 seconds as everybody sort of sat there and went, So that was, and again, that's the sort of executive sponsor thing, right? She was one of Jeff's right-hand people, and she still couldn't quite move that forward because there's enough busyness and institutional pressure to innovate that, she couldn't really do that. In Heroku, my team does a lot of that. We communicate with every team, and we're in retrospectives with them multiple times a week, and we tend to have fairly close connections between teams based on sort of personal, I get along with Greg and my other teammate gets along with Tim and whatever. And so that winds up being, it's a much smaller organization, we're about 250 people, that winds up being more of a gossip protocol. So that's sort of two extremes of how that might work. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Charlie Wetzel from LinkedIn. So do you have any advice for trying to teach your devs some ops discipline?
Well, I think it depends on which, what are you thinking of? Playbooks, right, to institutionalize your responses to certain pages? Are you thinking of how to stop having the same problem over and over again, or something else I haven't come up with?
I'm in the position where we kind of got my team moved into an SRE role from an ops role, right? So now we're much more closely embedded with our devs. And I have situations where we've got people who have have like no systems experience whatsoever, but they need to get onto a box, and now they've got power to get root on a box and install whatever they want to, even though that they're not empowered to do so by policy, they do it anyway. And I'm trying to figure out how to teach them, this is bad, you can't do that.
So I would start having lunch with small numbers of people and telling stories from my past about when that went horribly wrong or other things that went horribly right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Courtney. It's been a great talk.
Thank you. Thank you.